many of the homeless activists of Santa Cruz, myself included, I might add, have not been particularly aware of the need to deal with the issues of toxics and the environment.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you about that, and eventually I'm also going to ask you specific projects you think you're going to recommend that people involve themselves in it for those who do want to help.
Thank you for this opportunity, Robert.
Sure.
You know, my role in the community is the role of a priest, and that's a very traditional role, but people really don't get that priest is not really about religion. The core dynamic of the priest class or the priest focus is the security of people, the security of the human conditions, and the security and well-being of the constituents. And
welfare of the community, perhaps.
Of the community. Yeah. And when people see me focused on toxics, they figure, well, that's an issue that is far from them, but that's an issue facing the security and the welfare of our community.
Mm-hmm.
And same as homelessness and food deprivation. These are security issues. And it's appropriate that the organization that I work with is called the Committee for Universal Security. And right now, in the human community, we have not recognized the need for a universal security mechanism that would secure our peoples from various threats, many threats, threats of homelessness, threats from toxic chemicals, threats from nuclear annihilation, and what have you. Right now, when we talk about security, we're basically talking about, first of all, securing finances in those wealth holders who are working to keep that their wealth secured. Then we're talking about military security, armament security, which is about securing borders, securing nations. And then we're talking about personal security, which is about securing persons, like the security net around presidents and heads of state.
Let me ask you this, Benet, because I'm gonna interrupt you and try to direct you, because I am kind of hosting here.
Yeah.
You were focusing on Wednesday on concerns about toxics in the environment.
Absolutely.
And that is a major concern of yours.
Right. And that was a prerequisite to what I'm saying, mm-hmm. because you said earlier that I haven't gotten your attention yet. And it's hard to get people's attention unless they realize that there's a threat to their security.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm talking about.
Well, maybe you can give us some specific examples of the threat to the security, and in so doing, talk about particular toxics that you think should be of specific concern here in Santa Cruz.
Okay. Right now, we have a particular issue, and that is the proposal by the California State Legislature to mandate that all of California's drinking water be fluoridated.
Mm-hmm. I read about that in the paper.
With a compound called hydrofluorosilic acid.
Which the dentists tell us is a great thing, right?
I think that is coming from the Chemical Corporation, that this is a great thing.
Well, my dentist tells me that.
Well, it's basically generated from a real great thing about fluoride, mm-hmm. and that is communities and people who have wells which are naturally fluoridated from the mineral fluoride has shown that they have strong teeth.
Yeah.
And are resistant to cavities.
Mm-hmm. Which is important among homeless people.
Right. Hydrofluorosilic acid is not that compound, mm-hmm. nor is sodium fluoride that compound, nor is fluoride which is generated from electrolysis. They do not come anywhere near close to replicating natural fluoride.
Now, do you have any sources for this, or you want to press on to skeptics who are saying, oh, this is just another loony right-wing John Bircher anti-fluoridator person, you know? Any studies that you want to, say, put forward?
Oh, yeah, well, we got a study here that shows that fluoride that they want to use, which is not a pharmaceutical grade of fluoride. It's a fluoride that is basically being recycled from the fertilizer industry. This is from the phosphate fertilizer industry. They are basically taking their waste and selling it to water districts and placing it in our water as a so-called usable fluoride. And these fluorides basically carry other chemicals with them. They're usually contaminated with lead, antimony and arsenic and similar other toxic compounds. And they're saying this is a way to recycle if you get, the mess.
Make a little extra money, in other words.
Yeah.
Make a lot of extra money, perhaps.
But we have some timelines on this proposal. And the timeline for this proposal to come to a vote in the Health and Human Services Commission is July 12th. So we're asking the community to contact Henry Mellor's office.
Do you have a phone number?
By phone, 425-0401.
425-0401 is Henry Mellor's office number.
And by fax, 916-448-0175.
Can you repeat that?
By fax, 916-448-0175.
Now, if you didn't get those numbers, the Reverend will have a chance to repeat them before the call's over. So
right.
Get a pencil.
And if you need more information, you can call our committee at
429-9623. Mm-hmm. 429-9623, which is the committee for...
Universal Security.
Universal Security.
Zero Tolerance Toxic Campaign.
And do you have any particular projects coming up other than this opposition which you want to invite people to join?
Yes, we do, but I need to say much more about this opposition and that we
I figure about five more minutes.
I need less than 5 minutes.
Go for it.
We're asking people to come to a meeting this Monday, July 3rd at 6 p.m. At the Environmental Council's office, which is located at 903 Pacific Avenue in room 210. We are hoping to put a broad-based coalition of people in the community from various organizations to oppose this state proposal on the local level here. We urge you to attend.
And again, the meeting time and place?
The meeting time and place is this Monday, July the 3rd at 6 p.m., address 903 Pacific Avenue in room 210.
That'd be Monday, I believe, right?
It's coming Monday. It's not the best time to have it, but it's the only opportunity that we have to put a good, strong opposition up.
Now, if they can't attend, they should give your committee a call in order to ask what kind of help they can provide?
Absolutely.
Okay, so if you can't attend to this meeting and you're interested in what the Reverend is saying, give a call to... Give us the number again, could you?
Give a call to 408-429-9623.
429-9623. And again, perhaps those numbers for Henry Mellor, in case people want to call him directly to oppose the bill, whose number is?
Henry Mellor's number is 425-0401 by phone and 916-448-0175 by fax.
And the bill number?
The bill number is AB-733.
Uh-huh. And where can people get more written literature on this bill to educate themselves about it?
Ironically, some of the best information that you can get is coming from Henry Mellor himself. And he has a packet out that contains the pros and cons of fluoridation. And you can get that from him. And of course, you can go to any of the libraries and look up the fluoridation process.
So the public library downtown does have that?
Absolutely.
And Henry Mellor's office is, where can people go to the office?
Henry Mellor's office is at 701 Ocean Street in the county building.
Is on the fifth floor or something?
No, on the third floor.
The third floor of the county building, that's the big, gawky, waffle-ish, actually, it's the high building next to the court building. So after you get out of jail, go to court, you can go up to Henry's office on the third floor and find out what kind of water you've been drinking, right?
Okay.
Are they fluoridating the water here currently in Santa Cruz?
Santa Cruz water is not fluoridated because early in the 70s, the citizens of Santa Cruz opted not to have their water fluoridated.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill will mandate fluoridation. Because the chemical companies in the old days, they thought that everybody just would jump onto their lies about fluoridation was good for their teeth. The people didn't jump onto that. And they went to another phase of propagating this fluoridation process by putting it in toothpaste and various other things. Now they have a new strategy, and that is to mandate that all of the United States be fluoridated state by state. So they're operating here in California now to get our state to go fluoridation, and we have to absolutely oppose this
Is there any federal law, which any federal action around fluoride that you know of?
There are a number of senators who are objecting to fluoridation. Senator Waxman is objecting to fluoridation. Ron Dellums is objecting to
fluoridation. You're thinking of Representative Waxman and Representative Dellums, the House of Representatives?
Yes.
Right. Go ahead.
And there are several others. I fail to remember them all by name, but there is strong opposition in Congress to fluoridation.
Has there been any federal action in terms of legislation that you're aware of around fluoridation in the last couple decades?
There are this same proposal that we are looking at in California and many other states. So this fluoridation process is lobbied by the
How many states have accepted fluoridation that you know of?
Very few. There's very few cities in California that has accepted fluoridation.
Now, do you find yourself making common cause with what some of us would have called extreme right-wingers on this issue?
I don't even see that, Mr. Norris. I'm looking at the focus for the well-being in our community, and I take a very intelligent point of view, and I see those people as highly unintelligent, and they are not foes to the ongoing movement to usurp our ignorance.
Although I think you'll find, ironically, that perhaps a lot of intelligent literature against fluoride, and I speak from ignorance because I'm not educated on the subject.
There are no intelligent literature against ignorance. Even the books, the toxicological books, shows that fluoride is a toxic product.
No, what I'm saying is, I'm saying that much of the opposition to fluoridation in the 60s came from groups that were called extreme right wing, such as the John Birch Society, and I'm not one to bandy about labels a lot, but I find it kind of interesting, like that some of the issues that they raised, and the John Birch Society still exists. They had a meeting at the Loudoun Nelson Center about a month and a half ago. I believe would probably have literature that might interest your group on fluoridation.
And I have seen some of those literature, right?
On critical of fluoridation, in other words, opposing fluoridation, right?
But That literature is basically propaganda. That literature does not has a toxicological point of view. The toxicological point of view of fluoride explicitly states that it is a toxic product.
Mm-hmm.
The difference that these people like to make is that, but small amounts of it is good for us.
Well, of course, that's not what the John Birch Society says.
The John Birch Society has taken many extreme stances in saying that even fluoride was a part of the communist threat.
Right.
The Russians
were
doing it.
Right.
Anybody with any intelligence will not even look at that crap.
Right, that's true. That's true. On the other hand, it may be mixed with scientific studies which attack...
That's what we're talking about. When you get to science,
right,
when you get right down to science will tell you that fluoride is toxic.
Right.
Science will tell you that. Not only will science tell you that, but the EPA and the way we register these products, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sodium fluoride is a registered pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
Chlorine is a registered pesticide. These products is registered as toxics, and they are recognized by a panel of scientific peers to be so. The issue that we're looking at is whether or not we will take this propaganda campaigned by the chemical industries to sell us small amounts of it, which is purported to be good for us. And what we need people to look at and say that the product is the poison, not the dose level. So what they're saying, that the dose level, if the dose level doesn't poison you, then you're all right. And we're saying, hey, the product is the poison.
Well,
and then we have the overall picture of toxic products.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in our world today, 80 billion pounds per minute of toxic products are being produced.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only given a small doses of this here and there, a small dose here and there. We cannot tolerate an ongoing and expanding amount of that proportion.
Do you have any recommendations for people new to this field?
Mr. Robert Norris, I would like for you not to cut me off in the middle of my sentence.
Sorry, that's my job. Go ahead, though.
Thank you. We cannot afford to have 80 billion pounds per minute of toxic products produced for the next 10 years without poisoning the whole dynamics of our biological system.
I'm going to cut you off now, and I'm going to ask you if you have any recommendation for people to read in terms of, say, literature, well, I should say more like simple books that you would think would be useful for people in generally educating themselves on this issue.
The real information about this product comes from the toxicological data. You can find that in Clinical Toxicology of Commercial Products, or you can find that in an Encyclopedia of Chemical Technology.
Any popular works that you recommend?
The most popular work that you can look at would be a work by Deborah Lynn Dodd called Non-Toxic and Natural.
Deborah Lynn Dodd, Non-Toxic and Natural. And do you know if that book is in the public library?
Yes, it is.
So folks who are interested can check that one out of the library. They can give you a call at
408-429-9623.
And they can call Senator Mello, State Senator Mello, at
425-0401.
And I want to thank you, Benet, for being on the air here, and I also want to encourage you to consider doing your own show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are interested in having people do their own programs, and if you call me after the show, or if you call my number at Huff, 423-HUFF, I can certainly put you in touch with those who can, get you to come to a radio meeting, and then, you can perhaps have an hour or two of your own so you don't have to suffer these constant interruptions from guys like me.
Well, I thank you very much. I wanted to say something about Linda Evans.
Please, Edwards. Yes, go ahead.
And Linda Edwards. As a priest, I have baptized a lot of people into this community. I've married people in this community. And I am burying people in this community. I am burying a lot of people who are dying from so-called cancers. Linda Evans was Edwards was another such person.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Edwards died from exposure to environmental pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
She died from liver cancer. The liver is an indicator of impurities in our biosystem, of our life system. We are seeing women over and over again with a great many type liver, breast, and stomach cancers. Men with prostate cancers and testes cancers. This is a strong indicator that we have a serious toxic problem. We cannot let our people go down to these diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to pay homage to Linda Edwards because she was a tireless and fearless fighter for the rights and well-being of our peoples and our communities. We need to look at other avenues of fighting for the well-being of our community, and that is from toxic threats. I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to say these things, and I look forward to seeing you on the streets where our struggle is.
And I hope that you will find your own show on the air and give us more regular reports on this struggle.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Reverend Benet, whose last name I always fumble. I'd like to apologize for that. And I want to thank him for giving us a call and talking to us about subject of concern that I'm glad someone is looking into, because as I said, I have not taken much of an interest in it. But there's some information for you to begin with, some numbers to call, some books to read, and who knows, maybe a new radio show on that subject somewhere down the line. The phone lines are open. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM, 427-3772, or 427 Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC. These are the call numbers, the call letters. This is what you call to get this station, and we're waiting to hear from you. I'm wondering if anybody listened last night to the Urban Campers Hour on KKUP-FM. I put out information that there was a show about new anti-homeless laws in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties on KKUP between 10:30 at night and midnight last night. I actually was going to speak on that show, but unfortunately, mea culpa, I completely forgot about it and nobody called me, so I wasn't able to speak. But if anybody heard KKUP last night and wants to call in and describe what happened for our listeners who can't get KKUP or didn't know about it, that'd be very helpful, and I'd be grateful if you would do that. That's a show that shows up every one or two months called the Urban Campers Hour on 91.5 FM on radio station KKUP, which does some good stuff. They followed the controversy around Mayor Squawkbox Scott Kennedy last fall when he put his name writ large on a big Resource Center for Nonviolence Gandhi Memorial, Gandhi Centennial, I think it was. And I found that particularly offensive because Kennedy was the man who a lot of us placed a lot of trust and faith in to stop anti-homeless actions, violations of civil liberties for unpopular groups here in Santa Cruz as council member when he was elected in 1990. And in 1994, as mayor, he was helping to pass the worst anti-homeless laws in the state of California, the downtown ordinances, which are currently in force. And he has been unrepentant about that. He has been unrelentingly hostile in any conversations I've had with him. In fact, he won't talk to me anymore. He's a major disappointment on this issue. And of course, he seems to be taking conservative stands right and left on the city council, whether it be the police department, the location of the police department, whether it be weakening the Civilian Police Review Board, which I believe he helped delay and hamstring. And the Civilian Police Review Board that we have here in Santa Cruz is a pathetic mock-up of a Civilian Police Review Board that can't even get a copy of a police complaint, even though they're mandated by law to get copies of police complaints. The police department insists that they walk over like little poodles to the police department, read the complaint there while being watched by a police officer, and then waddle on back to the room where they have their meeting at the city manager's office or at the city hall. And it's simply a symbolic indication of the kind of role that they really expected to play, which is a rubber stamp for the Internal Affairs Department, the Internal Affairs section of the police department. And it's disgraceful. It's typical. I mean, it's the case in certain other cities, most other cities, you might even say, that have semblances of police review, although there are better police review boards in different cities that Santa Cruz chose not to emulate. Berkeley, for instance, is one of them. Even though the Berkeley board is itself badly crippled, it at least has the power to have an independent investigation of charges. That is to say, and when our board wants to independently investigate, they have to go to the city council for funding to get an independent investigator. And they haven't done this yet, and I don't expect that to be happening anytime soon. In Berkeley, that is a part of the whole process. Up there, the independent investigator is routinely a part of any complaints that come in. Complaints come directly to the board. They don't go through the Internal Affairs Department of the police first. And also, there is a public hearings are guaranteed on any complaint that comes up. And under the current policies of our board, public hearings can be closed and are not a mandatory part of the process, which I think is vital for the credibility of such a board. Also vital, and missing both from the Berkeley board and from our board, is independence of the city manager, who can simply ignore the results, even if they find some cop has beat the living daylights out of some person, and simply the department can do what it wants, as is happening in San Francisco in the Aaron Williams case. And the cry of cover-up is spreading throughout that city, as it justly should in these kinds of situations where police irresponsibly and arrogantly abuse the power that they are entrusted with by the community to protect the weakest people in the community, to protect the community. Another thing that our Civilian Police Review Board needs, in my opinion, and I encourage you to call in if you disagree, or if you have something to add, or if you've had an experience with the police that you think the public should know about, or that you want to bring to my attention, whether it be police, sheriffs, security guards, university police, hosts down on the mall, the kind of the mini wannabe cops. The other thing that the Civilian Police Review Board here and in Berkeley needs, both of them need, is some kind of prosecutorial mechanism. When you have a DA like Art Danner, or even the previous DA who was here, Phil Harry, so-called liberal, you get it gets bogged down in politics unless there is a particular focus on dealing with police abuses, a particular check against police abuses. Now, Santa Cruz police, they're abusive, I'm afraid. You know, there is no check on the beatings that happened on May 11th, 1994, videotaped, witnessed by hundreds, spread by the media, and our police chief Belcher has done nothing about them. The Civilian Police Review Board says it can do nothing about them because they occurred before May 30th, 1994, which is their date of inception. Although, of course, they could consider the policies of crowd control that could make some, express some concern, but they're not. And now, people want to say, well, this is a new board, let's forgive them, let's give them a lot of rope. That's not my way. I believe you have to pull people, you have to really make clear what you need initially, or you're likely to have what you had before, which is a total lack of accountability, subservience to those in power, who are currently the city council, the city manager, the city attorney, a whole gang of people fundamentally indifferent to the rights of the poor. They have never been poor. They couldn't care less what it's like to live on the streets. They routinely press charges against people like Wanton Dave Jacobs, like Red Top Robert Flurry, homeless activists who are peacefully and nonviolently trying to bring the attention of the community to ongoing, blatant, unconscionable injustices, routine violations of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, for example, around the sleeping ban, which our city is enshrined in its local ordinance, thou shalt not sleep after 11 o'clock at night. And the response of the city attorney is to have these people, is to spend literally thousands of dollars. Actually, for Jacobs, I would say it amounts to hundreds of thousands of dollars. He's been tried, he's 15 trials, 15 misdemeanors against him, maybe 16, all of which have either been resulted in acquittals, dismissals, or the case is overturned on appeal, all to intimidate, attempt to drive him away, to intimidate others from emulating what he does, which is simply, as a homeless person, as a peace activist, as a former vet, to insist on the same rights in public spaces that people who are richer, people who are more dressed in more fancy and conventional clothing have, and to bring to the attention of the citizenry, to bring to the attention of the merchants and of the visitors and the tourists, the community and the world, the realities of the human rights situation in Santa Cruz by distributing literature, by doing a sleep out downtown, as he has done on numerous occasions, and by talking about the issue to passers-by who are willing to stop and talk with him. I believe Dave has gone out of town to the Rainbow Gathering, which is happening in New Mexico. And if anybody, by the way, wants to phone in and offer rides to the Rainbow Gathering for other people listening, that might be useful. I understand a lot of people want to go there with the Food Not Bombs UN gathering ceremony is essentially over. People are dispersing. I'm being told they're going to different places, including Rainbow Gathering, Earth First Actions up in Northern California, and some third place, Utah. I was told, let me check my notes. Let's see here. Not clear. But anyway, if anybody has any information in terms of offering transportation, or anybody's interested in informing us about what's happening at the Rainbow Gathering, and if anybody's come back from there or has heard anything from there or has any information, give a call to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 89.3 FM. And the phone number is, of course, 427-3772. And I also invite Linda LeMaster, Lighthouse Linda, mainstay activist in our community, to give a call. She was going to join me on the air this morning, and for some reason she has not shown. We were going to be talking, and will be talking, I'm hoping to have her talk, about Linda Edwards, Linda the Lark Edwards, activist who died earlier this month, and who was sexually assaulted before she died. And that's something which, as I said, we discussed on Monday, which I again intend to discuss today. And I will encourage people to contact the sheriff's office and to contact the DA's office to make sure this investigation does not die, but presses on, and to hopefully ensure that charges are filed and the justice is done in this case. But I want to wait, and before I begin this subject formally, for Linda LeMaster to call. The names these names are actually from the Street Shit Sheet, a homeless newsletter that I edit and I've written for about 8 years, which describe these activists, sometimes with colorful names. And it looks like I'm getting a phone call now, so maybe this is someone I know calling in on the phone.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi there, this is Linda calling in. It's promised I'd hope to be there, sorry.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm glad to hear you, Linda. I was a little worried that maybe that you've been hauled off in some strange way.
Are we on the air?
Now, we are indeed on the air.
Well, I'll keep my strangeness to myself then.
Oh, well, as you wish. Sometimes you can't even hide, it's hard for us to hide our strangenesses.
I will say there's an awful lot of police downtown. It must be the holiday weekend starting a day early.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you and I were talking last Monday about Linda Edwards' death, and I feel that it might be appropriate for us to sort of work over the same ground we did at that time for those who weren't listening, because at the memorial services, I promised people that we would raise this issue again, and many of them perhaps didn't know that it was going to be on the air, and I'm hoping that some of those who are interested are listening now.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can, how do you feel about that?
As long as you're asking the questions, I'll play along.
Okay. It's unfortunate that you're not in the studio because it means that we can't have call-ins while the two of us are talking. Is there any way you can get down to the studio?
I hope to come there, but I seem to be babysitting an extra kid that I didn't commit to, and until that changes, which could be any minute, mm-hmm. I think I'm stuck here.
Now children come first. But why don't we go ahead then and talk about it, and what I'll do is I will allow for phone time spaces so people can call in. You can hear their questions and their thoughts, and then I would encourage you to call back, and you can respond that way. Because as I was telling the folks out there in the radio land, you were the last, well, you were the person there when Linda died, and you were present when, sometime shortly after these sexual assaults occurred. Maybe you can...
And perhaps during, depending on people's definitions.
All right, maybe you can tell us what happened.
I'll give you a little bit.
Okay.
I walked in to visit her Saturday afternoon.
This was at, where was she now?
She's at Hillhaven Convalescent Home.
We're talking about a woman who was terminally ill of liver cancer who died within a day after these events occurred, correct?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
And she had been at Hillhaven for a couple months altogether, and up to a week or less before she died, just the day short of a week, I thought she was doing pretty well. She was, able to function in some ways and to cope with, psychologically cope with her dying and one part after another giving out. And we got to visit her son exactly the week before she died. You and myself and Gloria, we had a nice visit. The next day she fell. That was a Sunday, the week before she died. And she had to be seen at Dominican, and they sent her back there, and she told me she knew she was almost gone now, that she wouldn't be able to recover from having fallen on top of everything else.
This is a woman who was diagnosed over a year ago having liver cancer. She was 47 years old, and she was given only 3 to 6 months to live, but this was almost a year, if not a little more than a year after that diagnosis, and 6 months after supposedly her deadline for life. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and also I think in the big picture it's important to know that this is a woman who's essentially indigent by practical standards in our society.
Mm-hmm. She lived in her van, as I understand it, and refused to take government handouts.
Yeah, and I think even when it got to the point where the liver cancer was so all-consuming that she was hurting all the time and weak from enduring the pain, she still had the intention of just you know, sort of in a native or indigenous way, going off alone and just dying with her own dignity intact. But as fate would have it for most people in our society, it got to the point where she didn't have a say about that. And her friends saw to it that she got some hospital care and some pain medication. And ultimately, when they put her in Hill Haven, she told me, they let her know that this is a place where you come to die, not to heal.
Yeah, Hill Haven was, my perception, interrupting you briefly, it was a place where there were many women, I would say, over 70 there. It was hard to find anybody who looked any less than 70, and who were often in wheelchairs, white-haired, all to a woman, and very few men. And Linda was by far the youngest person there.
Yeah. She could have been grandchild to someone in there, for all we know. One of the nurses said she's the youngest person that's ever stayed there.
Really?
And Linda and I had some chats back before she was losing her voice about the irony that she would be the one to get liver cancer, you know. I don't know. I don't want to get off on a tangent too much, but I think who she is as important as the dastardly part of this story. But I remember her so vividly trying to, all by herself almost, you know. She came to me and she came to Kim or Gulen. She looked for other women to be moral support for this position, but down at the time there was a post office vigil that was really beautiful.
This is in 1990 when homeless people were opposing police violence and the anti-homeless sleeping ban here in Santa Cruz.
And I think really effectively standing up to the right to have a presence, to be homeless and still be human, and treated like part of the fabric of society, I think that vigil effectively did that. And that's why it threatened people and people called the police a lot. But in the context of this, what we were calling the homeless table, the people who were running it and keeping it going and making it vital for a lot of homeless people. I mean, you didn't even, there was not a place in town you could park a backpack anywhere at the time. Anywhere.
And there was no shelter facilities, no lockers. I think they were even stopping people from using the bus station.
Well, they were all full. There was no bus station lockers. I know that from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
They were always all full. And, I mean, that's just one thing. So it became kind of like a outdoor switchboard. I think it's an important thing. And it accomplished a great deal.
This was a table sitting in front of the post office for 8.5 months, 24 hours a day, which Linda Ezra Edwards frequently slept at.
And she worked with these guys, but I remember a point came where it became kind of popular to keep warm at night by being drunk. And Linda objected to that. And she tried to get these guys to hear it. And they didn't want to hear it, especially when they were drinking, right? So ultimately she just decided, well, I can't in good conscience be a part of this. So she went across the street and set up another table.
I remember.
And I mean, that conveys to me, for me, something of her spirit.
She did that frequently. She did tables for Cop Watch that were her own initiative. She did tables to protest bad food, censorship, and violence at the Free Meal, which were her initiative after she was assaulted out there by employees of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program and by friends of Karen Gillette. And these people were neither punished nor disciplined that I was aware of.
There was not even an honest dialogue about it.
And there was no grievance process by the William James Association, the group that was overseeing that, the Paul Lee, Paige Smith, Citizens Committee for the Homeless clone that was doing the coverage of the supposedly writing herd on the Free Meal. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Wait a minute. I think it's very relevant, you know, because Linda was the kind of woman that, yeah, she just didn't let somebody kick her or beat her up and stomp on her petition and then forget about it and lick her wounds and hide, you know.
Which actually happened. Her petition for good, healthy food and for an end to censorship at the Free Meal in 1992 in the spring was torn out of her hands by an employee there in full vision of Karen Gillette, who was running the Free Meal. Petition was stomped and ripped, and Gillette did nothing. Apparently, she also smiled at the time, as I remember. She felt that apparently Linda was a detriment to...
I'm trying to guess what Karen felt.
Who knows? But what was said later was
Karen
we were trying to...
Karen was no help and was not appropriate.
The information information, yeah, the information that was spread later, whether through her or others, was that Venda was trying to close down the free meal, which was not true.
That was a typical lie of the time.
Yeah, many lies were spread about Linda Edwards, and many acts of violence she had to deal with, some of them from official sources, some of them from individuals misinformed through official sources, some of them from her fellow activists, and I guess that brings us back to the...
Well, let me finish this point first.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to say that her stand against the excessive drinking, as she saw it, indicates something about her lifestyle, that even though she lived in her van, she was very careful, and she didn't... there were no excesses in what she ate and drank.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't a drinker at all.
So, she told me there in Hillhaven how it seemed a sad irony as she was beginning to grapple with this cause of dying and the fact of dying. She, you know, that there's this one part of her that doesn't understand why this, of all things, had to be her. It didn't make sense, you know. I mean, at the same time...
This, of all things, meaning?
Well, that your liver would go.
Oh, the liver, yeah, liver, you know, customarily associated with drinkers, yeah.
Yeah, drinking leads to cirrhosis, but in general, the liver, it's a cleaner, so people that get bad livers are people who have to do double duty on cleaning toxins out of their body. That's what wears it out, you know, whether it's cancer or whatever. And it just, you know, I agree with her, because I knew her pretty well. It just seems an irony that that's what would take her out, you know. And I think that makes a point between, you know, we recognize, those of us who knew her, and were inspired by her, we recognize her activism and it's the fundamental rightness and, let's say, the moral ground that she always came from. And maybe we overlook, because of the whatever language society, how personal it was for her. I think she embodied more than anyone I've ever gotten to know personally that the personal was political and vice versa, and that's real. And that, you know, her campaign for many years for an upgrade in the quality and accessibility of food for people who had to live on the streets and some who chose to, was because she needed it. She knew she needed it, you know. And she had a few friends, and, you know, I've seen you feed her. And she had options that a lot of homeless people don't have, as hard as her life was, you know. So... You'll just have to bring us back artificially, too.
Yeah, let's get back to the... I was kind of trying to bring us back by saying that she suffered violence from people on the street who would come up to her table and turn it over, and she had abusive relationships with some men. Many of her lovers were from the street who she met in the struggle for human rights here in Santa Cruz. And one of those people, I believe, is the subject of our conversation today, or...
Well, I'm not willing to... If you're talking about the man who raped her on her deathbed, I'm
yes.
not willing to concede that he is one of her lovers. Linda was a loving person. And I think Shard... Now, this is an opinion that I'll probably pay for the rest of my life for putting on the radio, but I think Shard men and men who are lost in some private delusion...
Such as this man was.
An agape love that Linda so personified in her life toward everyone as something they should take personal. Now, this is an opinion I've developed.
I don't understand what you're saying, Linda. Maybe you can repeat that.
Well, if you're going to refer to this group of people as her lovers, I think you need to be a little clear what you mean.
Well, let's not quibble. Let's just talk about what happened that night for the audience. We've been kind of talking a lot about her background, but talk about the evening of the rape and what happened then.
Well, this is what I know about what happened. I was trying to visit her a lot because I could see she wouldn't be with us much longer after that fall. So I visited her Friday night before she died, and I left in the evening to have a child I had to feed, and I had my first ever self-defense workshop. And I left there, and I think you and Doug and this guy, Brian
Flanagan Staley, is his name,
were visiting her.
Yeah.
And when I came back and wanted to visit her the next morning, mid-morning.
On Saturday morning, the day she died.
Uh-huh.
June 3rd.
This guy is in her bed, under her covers, and he won't get out. He won't move. He's kind of dominating the area, which is a third of a room built to put up two people to die, but it had beds for three, so it's a little crowded. And he's just sort of obstinately taken control of administering to her. At least that's what he's asserting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to engage him in a conversation. Doug was there when I came in.
Tell the audience who Doug is.
Doug is Linda's caretaker, and he's really been by her side for the last 10 months.
Longer than that, Doug has been her close friend and companion for the last decade and a half, actually.
But I mean by her side daily, taking care of her while she was dying of cancer.
Right.
And in some sense, companion and lover.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you that term in this case, because I know from what Linda has said that they care about each other and they went places together.
Mm-hmm.
Looked out for each other. But, and Doug is... Even after she was in Hillhaven, and even though he has a full-time job, he was by her side at least daily. And he was pretty tired by the time the story that we're trying to get out began. So when I showed up Saturday morning, apparently Doug had kind of been a little stunned to find this guy in his bed under her covers beside her, and the bed cranked up to a vertical 90-degree angle. But Doug and Brian were new. They hadn't met each other before the night before that, I guess. So he left for coffee, and Brian, because I was there, he felt like it's okay to leave. And Brian